Hello and welcome to Alliance Manchester Business School's Original Thinking Podcast. Today's podcast was recorded at our latest Scale Up Forum event. The Scale Up Forum is a peer-to-peer network for ambitious scaling up businesses in Greater Manchester. It gives businesses at all stages of the scale-up journey the opportunity to share experiences, challenges, and lessons learned for mutual business benefit. At this Scale Up Forum event, Bruce Tether, Professor of Innovation Management and Strategy, AMBS, and industry speaker Azar Quayoum, Director and CEO, Q-Sustain, discuss how to achieve innovation and incorporate innovation strategies into companies.
It's my pleasure to give you the textbook version of how you do this before we have Azar tell you how to do it in reality, real practice. So, okay, so this is about achieving innovation and innovation strategies. I should turn it around and start thinking about strategies first before thinking about achieving innovation. Okay, so what is innovation, right? Innovation is a nice popular topic. Everybody wants to be an innovator these days. So what is it? So it has lots of definitions. Here's a very simple one. It's the successful implementation of new ideas. Perhaps a rather big, broad definition, but so a slightly narrow one is innovation is the implementation of significantly improved products or processes or marketing methods or organizational methods, business practices, workplace organizations, or external relations. That comes from the OECD. So again, it's a big space. You can do lots of different types of innovation. There's not one type of innovation. What about a few myths about innovation? There are lots of myths about innovation. So one of the big myths is that innovation starts with invention. You invent something in your shed, perhaps, and then you think it's a bit of genius, and you decide to go out and market it, and that's the start of your innovation journey. Another myth of innovation, and is something which the politicians are often guilty of, is they associate or they equate innovation with doing research and development. In particular, doing research, right? You kind of always need to do some development for achieving innovation, but you don't need to do research, okay? So especially you don't need to do scientific and technological research. You may do, but often you don't, right? I personally am a big fan of design and development as an approach to innovation, which is a bit different from research and development. But you may know that the government has an aim to increase our GDP spend on R&D to about 2.5%, which is a very laudable aim in this time. But personally, I think it's not really the right way to go about innovating if you're a smaller business seeking to grow rapidly. Another myth about innovation is that it's best to be first, right? As a kind of pioneering thing, it's always best to be the first with your first market. Well, a lot of innovation is not like that. A lot of innovation is actually imitating or doing something similar to someone else, right? In many ways, there are advantages of not being first, right? There are disadvantages of being first. Because if you're first, you have to prove the technology. You then have to prove the market. So let's take an example, okay? We're all familiar with Mr. Dyson and his vacuum cleaner, his bagless vacuum cleaner, right? Went on to be an enormous success. How did it start? Started by Dyson being unhappy with how his vacuum cleaner worked. Basically, it vacuumed the floor for a bit, got clogged up with dust, and it didn't work very well. He thought this is a bad product, okay? So then he became a bit obsessed with how to make it a better product, okay? And eventually was able to make a proper product and start selling it. But there are many types of uncertainty he had to overcome in developing this product. I mean, first of all, he had to make an alternative version to the conventional bag vacuum cleaner. And secondly, so that was a sort of technological uncertainty, but also he had this uncertainty of would it sell, right? Did anybody else think the bagless vacuum cleaner, the bagged vacuum cleaner was actually a bad product, right? That the bagless one would be so much better, right? So clearly people did, right? Because they went out and bought it. Lesser known story is that Dyson actually had another product which wasn't so successful. This was the washing machine, which washed in two different directions, right? It's kind of similar idea in a way for the bagless vacuum cleaner, in that it was a washing machine which washed the clothes better. In this case, however, nobody really noticed the difference, right? And they weren't prepared to pay the big price premium for getting the slightly better washing machine, right? So sometimes it's better not be first. You can observe instead someone else doing a product really well and say, well, I'll have a bit of that. I'll do something similar to that. And then you overcome all market uncertainties as well as technological uncertainties. Another myth is that innovation is disruptive. Okay, so we often think, oh, innovation is disruptive, is going to change the way things are, right? So, but a lot of innovation is not disruptive, right? A lot of innovation, in fact, the vast majority of innovation is incremental, right? It's cumulative, small changes. So it's not about making things suddenly dramatically better. I remember a study I did a few years ago, which was about increasing capacity, runway capacity at Heathrow Airport, okay? And this was a lot of innovations, small innovations in how the runway was utilized, right? And it had a combined effect to increase capacity, but it wasn't a disruptive innovation. It didn't sort of suddenly think, let's get rid of the runway and put a big helipad in there or something crazy, right? It wasn't, you know, so people tend to think about innovation as being this disruptive force. It can be, but it doesn't have to. Anyone think of any other myths about innovation? Anyway, we're going to have a bit of fun about myths about innovation, but these are some of the myths, okay? So broadly, innovation is two different things, right? Two different areas or zones. One is what we call product innovation in broad sense, right? Product innovation is what you provide to your customers, okay? So what is it you are selling? Why is it that someone would want something new or improved, such as a new improved vacuum cleaner or a new improved washing machine, okay? Improved also includes new services, new experiences. Doesn't have to be a physical product. The other is processes and organizational changes. So how do we do what we do, right? So maybe we can make the same product with a different process. We refine the process, we reduce our unit cost, and we're more efficient in doing so. So with services especially, there's often a kind of conflation of the two things, right? The service is the process and vice versa. But broadly, there are these two big zones of innovation. Product innovation generally gets a lot more kind of attention or credit than process and organization. Now, here's the news, folks. The UK is not very good at innovating, right? Or at least the UK doesn't innovate very much. This is a survey that the government undertakes every second year, and it asks firms, have you introduced a new or improved product or service or a new or improved process in the last 3 years? How many firms do you think said, yes, we have? And how many said, ooh, we haven't? Well, it turns out if you look at product innovation, about one in five companies with at least 10 employees said they've made a new or improved product in the last 3 years, okay? That means four-fifths haven't, okay? So right, you go, kind of doesn't change a lot, right? In 3 years, you haven't improved your product or introduce anything new. Process innovation is even worse, right? Whoops. Process innovations are even worse. It's kind of down between about 15%. This is amazing, right? I mean, process innovation is an opportunity to become more efficient at what you do. And yet only about 15% of British firms with 10 or more employees are reporting that they do process innovation to the ONS's survey of many thousands of firms, right? So why does this matter? It matters for companies which are growth orientated and have ambition. Innovation is fundamentally a way to grow, right? It's a way to expand your market by offering new and better products. And it's a way to improve your efficiency by doing process innovation. So the fact that British firms don't innovate very much is really worrying. There are kind of some more firms that are innovation active, which we expand the definition to things like changing your strategy or changing business processes, but still, you know, less than half of our companies are innovation active in even a fairly driven one. So how should we go about innovating, right? So there are two keys to innovation. One is doing the right projects, and the other is doing projects well, right? Okay, so let me discuss first doing the right projects. The right projects have to connect with strategy. What is your strategy? What is your objective? So firms can have different strategies. Growth is a strategy. Profit maximizing is a strategy. Being sustainable is a strategy. But according to Alfred D. Chandler, one of the founders of strategy, it's about long-term goals and objectives of the enterprise and adopting a course of action and allocating resources necessary to carry out these goals. Okay, so strategy is what you're trying to achieve. Has three basic elements, these objectives. So what are you trying to achieve? What would you like to do? Sometimes strategy is merely survival, right? So if you're in a busy, very contested industry, you might just want to survive. You may want to grow. This is a scale-up forum, so firms on this program should want to grow, right? You need to understand your environment. There's different elements of this, but for example, how can you protect your intellectual property, right? Are you existing in a regime in which you can protect your intellectual property, or is your intellectual property very vulnerable to copy, right? Or imitation? Thirdly, resourcing and developing the capabilities you need in order to undertake this strategy. So we can think of different strategies for different firms, even in the same industry or activity. So for example, let's say you are a inventor or invention-led, discovery-led business, and you have discovered some new chemical entity, right? Maybe a pharmaceutical or drug. Now your strategy is likely to be built around how you can protect that. Okay, so it's a protection-based strategy. You need to know about intellectual property rights. You probably need to know about the limitations of intellectual property rights, the role of secrecy, the role of reputation. These sort of things come into play. How aggressive are our opponents in the industry? Okay. Let's say you're following a different strategy. Your strategy is said to be a fast follower. Okay. You don't want to be first. Your strategy is to see what is emerging on the market and basically imitate that as soon as possible, right? You're not inventing first. Okay. So your strategy is different and the resources you need are different. Okay. It's an agility strategy. It's about maintaining the ability to jump into new areas very quickly. Okay. Very different relationships between the objectives and the resources and environment. Let me put that in a more empirical way. Here are two different architecture practices. Okay. At the top is Zaha Hadid. Okay, became a big architecture practice based on design-led unique solutions. Okay, amazing buildings, but it's about developing these bespoke amazing buildings, whereas down here is a totally different architecture practice. Its business is delivery-led. Okay, it's about delivering on time, on budget, being dependable, repeatable solutions. So you basically build the same building over and over again, and you do economies through building it over and over again. Totally different strategies of firms in the same industry, okay? So how do you think about strategy and innovation? As you can use something like the business model canvas, which was developed by Alexander Osterwalder. Anyone seen this thing? Okay, this is a fantastic tool, I think, for thinking about your business model and how to innovate in your business model. On one side, we think about the demand side focus. Who is your customer? Who are the customer segments you're trying to attend to? What do they want, right? This is your value proposition and your customer. So if we go to the two architecture practices, their customer segments very different, right? One wants grand iconic architecture. The other one's delivery, right? The other one's building student hall residence, something like this, right? How do you interact? What are your customer interaction channels? So we're going to think about that and our opportunities to innovate on the demand side. You know, maybe you've got to change the nature of product, change the way in which you interact with your customers. On the supply side, we can think about what you need to do those activities, okay? So you're going to think about the key resources you need, the key activities you need. So for example, you're probably going to need different types of architects, right? If you're going to follow these two different types of routes in the architecture industry in particular, right? You're going to need more of a mind for efficiency, delivery on time than developing wonderful shapes, for example. Okay, so these are kind of great. This is great. So what I do with my students is I ask them to look at an existing business model, and we compare an existing business and we compare and contrast against a revised one. I've got a couple of minutes. How long have I got? Okay. So the other key to innovating is doing projects well, right? So you're going to know your space, and you've got to know what types of projects you're going to do in your space. A project which might be right for someone else isn't going to be right for you, and vice versa. Okay, but then when we come to looking at how to do projects well, this is about doing projects in a way that has discipline. Okay, so the danger with innovation projects is they're subject to drift. They're subject to people saying, "Oh, well, this is my baby. I'm going to look after my baby. I love this idea. I'm going to keep it." You know, and they basically just sponsor their idea forever. This is particularly difficult where the project kind of the business owner, right? So often with small businesses, it's the owner, manager has the idea And nobody's going to tell him or her to no, stop. You're kind of a bit of a loony on this, right? It's not going to work, right? So what you want is some discipline. So innovation, someone's put some time in these slides. So some of innovation can be seen as a staged process, okay? So it's not one thing. We go through different stages. So first of all, we discover what might be desirable by our customers, what might be possible in terms of refining our processes. Then we define what it is we're trying to achieve. Then we spend time in development, right? This is about turning your ideas into something more tangible, more practically implementable. And then you move on to delivering it. And one of the keys to innovation is deciding when to kill it, right? When to stop. We should always evaluate an innovation project on its prospects going forward, not how much you've spent on it in the past. Okay? We call that the sunk cost fallacy. It's a bit like Concorde, right? We kept going with Concorde because we thought we spent all this money in the past. We can't give up on it. Or you might think HS2 is a bit like that. That's a controversial topic, right? But you know, you should really evaluate it on what it's going to cost you from tomorrow onwards, not how much you've already spent on it. I remember one of the questions I was asked for this is, should everybody contribute? Well, yes and no. Everybody should be involved, I think, in the front end, providing ideas, but not necessarily in evaluating, especially not evaluating, right? It's not a democracy. It's not like, how many people in this company think this is a good idea to do? And people put their hands up, and people kind of look at the boss and see if the boss put their hand up. I put my hand up because the boss put his hand up, right? So don't do that, right? Evaluate things independently of proposing things. Okay. Why is the front end particularly important? Front end is where you generate ideas, but it's also particularly important because it's very cheap. Right? If you can do the front end of innovation well, you can observe and get lots of ideas for innovation, right? Cheaply. If you have skills associated with it, design skills in particular, are good at understanding, empathizing what might be different, right? Look for what we call points of pain, right? Where are your customers' points of pain? What hurts them? Try to understand their points of pain and start to address them. But generally through innovation processes, our costs will increase, right? First bit is cheap, the middle bit is pretty expensive, but delivery, especially getting delivery wrong, is very expensive, right? So you've got to think about this and kill off innovation projects which aren't successful, aren't likely to be successful early on. What you want to do is actually start with lots of ideas here and cut them out, right? So I sometimes use the analogy of straws in a glass. So if we have lots of straws in a glass, everybody's taking a sip, then the water, the resource for innovation, gets basically spread amongst everybody. Too many projects, too thinly spread. Better to have one straw in the glass and all the resource going to that. So start off with lots of ideas, have one straw in the glass by the middle, right? And then implement it. Think about the cost. Then there's another good tool, I think, for innovation, or at least for kind of basic forms of innovation. It's called the stage gate process. Anyone come across a stage gate process? So stage gates is not a new idea. So it's been put around by a guy called Robert Cooper, I think in the early 80s, but it's an old tool, right? But old tools are sometimes good tools. You don't necessarily need to innovate your tools, right? Basically what it does is has stages and then assessment gates. So you undertake a stage, like you investigate the possibility of doing something for your customers or even looking for their pain points, right? You then give a presentation to the gatekeepers. The gatekeepers evaluate what you've done and allow you or not to proceed, right? And you basically go through stage gate evaluation. This has some benefits, right? One is that it gives a time discipline to innovation. You're told, okay, great work, but so come back next month and give us stage two. It stops drift. Doesn't allow the project to just drift on, and because people tend to start working their innovation projects on Friday afternoon and then they're not making a lot of progress, right? This gives a kind of time discipline. It also separates evaluation of the project from the doing of the project, okay? So we don't get to mark our own homework, This is a big problem with innovation, right? If you get to mark your own homework, especially if you're the boss of the company, you say, yeah, of course, it's a brilliant idea that I'm developing here, right? But you want to separate that. You want someone else or some other group of people to be evaluating your work and telling you, well, you know, this could be improved or that, right? It doesn't always have to flow down the chart all the way. You can, if you like, put it on the back burner, you can stop it. But basically, this is also about sort of traffic lights. Yeah, should it go forward? Should it be stopped? Should it be revised? Discipline, really important to put the discipline on the process. Typically, you're involving more and more senior decision makers as you go down this process, partly because costs are also escalating, going back to the previous slide, okay? So have a discipline. It's not just kind of free-for-all being crazy and creative innovation. It is a managed process. Okay, so here's my summary. So innovation matters for business growth. It's really hard to think of any business which hasn't grown through innovating, right? How do you grow without innovating? It's quite hard to know. Anyone think of a business that's grown without innovating? Just to be kind of counterfactual, right? Hard to think of a business which hasn't innovated. One business which did grow phenomenally with very little innovation was Coca-Cola, actually, between when they invented Coca-Cola and when they started getting into all sorts of drinks, right? But that doesn't work anymore, okay? They were very successful. But the vast majority of businesses can't grow without either product, process innovation, or indeed both, right? And surprisingly, very few UK firms innovate, or a small proportion, right? So there's a big opportunity space, I think, for more innovative companies. Secondly, what innovations to pursue depends crucially on your strategy, okay? So the connection between strategy and innovation should be clear. The right innovations for one company are the wrong innovations for another company, and vice versa. So don't all follow the same strategy. Use the business model canvas to explore opportunities for innovation. It's a brilliant tool for looking at what you're doing now. Use the canvas once for thinking, what am I doing now? And use a second canvas to think about what we might do instead. Okay, nice. I get my students to do that. I think they like it. Thirdly, managing innovation well also matters. Have a discipline about it, right? Be prepared to kill off your projects. Don't just allow them to drift. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Fantastic. I feel like that was a mini MBA class on innovation, which was very great and very interesting. Thank you for that. So it's now my pleasure to introduce Azhar Qayyum. He's joined us today. He's the director and founder of QSustain Limited. He's an entrepreneur and engineering professional with 20 years experience within sustainable design and delivery across different sectors, such as mixed use, commercial, and in particular, rail. He's creating first of its kind achievements across complex projects. This is coupled with invaluable experience in practical major programs and extensive knowledge of the feasibility, design, and implementation stages of these projects. With his experience, he now runs a successful consultancy that is well-placed to expand and diversify. He has a rare and exclusive combination of engineering design, sustainability, and practical project management experience, all very valuable, with knowledge of how to implement low-carbon and sustainable developments from concept design and procurement to construction and operation. Over to you, Azhar, with the practitioner perspective.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. So it's a tough act to follow. It's a great presentation there from Professor Bruce, but I'll give it a go. So thank you for the introduction, and thank you for having me here at the business school. Azhar Qayyum, it's me, Charleston Engineer. So I'm born and bred in Mancunian, stayed here on life, not traveled elsewhere in other projects. And we founded QSustain, we're in our ninth year now, and a lot of it was actually the dream and the skill to be innovative, really. A lot of what we do is about innovation. And from a young age, our family found it quite tough as an immigrant family coming to Manchester. I always saw my father as a great motivator for me because he was always full of great ideas, which is one of them I'm going to touch on today. But for me, it was a case of in the opportunity that I'm going to talk about today was about the space of sustainability and how product innovation and processing come together, where there's a real desire and need, and the pinch points that Professor Bruce talked about, we see in the clients that we work with. But a lot of the work we do is around low carbon technology, sustainability, product process engineering design within low carbon and air quality is what we do a lot of work in as well. And predominantly we are within the rail sector, we are moved into the housing sector as well, social housing, and looking at low carbon, carbon neutral kind of houses as well, for certain local authorities as well, which we've gone into as well. And we do a lot of studies around this, energy efficiency, carbon neutral studies, and looking at different types of technology solutions. The ones that you probably hear about now in the news, like heat pump technology, LED lighting and controls. But in terms of the need and how this was born about and how we started with Q-Sustain was, I worked on a very big, one of the biggest refurbishments in Europe at the time from 2008-09, which was a redevelopment of a big main train station within Birmingham, Birmingham Euston Station. And what we found here was there was lots of challenges around the station, because one of them was keeping the station operational through the works and the construction phase of this project. And it was nearly £750 million, we're talking about £600-700 million project. And as I started life into the project, coming into the engineering role and engineering management role, we were finding that there was lots of challenges around trying to be a sustainable project in respect of its energy. And in particular, there's other issues around how do you insulate. We've got loads of other requirements on disability acts, et cetera, to get more entrances, exits. What we found was the fact that we're doubling the energy demand because we're creating a station four times the size it used to be. You know, number of 28 US escalators, 31 new lifts to create a lot of connectivity around the station that didn't exist before because lots of pinch points there. And to me, that just didn't sit right. And forget about the whole business perspective and trying to then create a company from all this. Just really, it just didn't get that right feeling that how can I work on a project where we've got climate change and climate action becoming an increasing topic? And here we are on a very high profile scheme where we've not really thought about how to create a low carbon project. And yet we're doubling the energy demand and we're asking the energy grid to double its supply with big transformers and lots of infrastructure there. And that's really where, to me, I thought we've got to do things differently here. And hence the innovation side probably in me, as well as the entrepreneurial. So we can't just carry on like this, or not just this project, but loads of projects that are like this as we're going into a stage where our climate action, climate awareness is such a big topic. So for me, when we started out, it wasn't just, right, I want to be entrepreneurial, I want to open a business and I want to do X, Y, and Z and become very successful. Yes, profit's important for every company, as well as the innovation side. But for me, the bigger thing was the purpose. And if I could balance the two, then I'd be a very happy person trying to grow a company in that way. And both are required. And at the time, going back 10 years, it wasn't so much the case. This was always questioned more than that was. And I was always seen as a disruptor, but also a troublemaker in a lot of the projects I work on, not just on train stations. But now we're getting into the world of CSR and ESGs, and now, you know, stock markets and all these big business people and finance people are now actually looking at the credentials of companies and their links towards fossil fuels and climate action. And they're actually becoming more attractive, more sustainable companies are now, the more they're looking at ESGs and CSRs, and we get lots of inquiries now about this. But the fact is that going forward, we're going to a growing population. The next 8 years, we're going to be over 8.5 billion. And we're going to need a lot more energy, water, food. We've got a lot of emerging markets. We've got developing economies. And they're all going to need a slice of the cake. And in a time where climate change is absolutely real and the catastrophes are happening around us. But for us, it was a case of recognizing this and coming up with solutions and innovations to help create more sustainable developments. But whereas traditionally, a lot of people in our realm of consultancy were around this stage of creating concepts and designs and then sending them out to the clients and saying, there you go, we've done a study on how to be more efficient on how to create renewable technologies. For us, the key is to keep with the client and go through the whole project cycle to look at how you procure that technology. How do you then build it? How do you get the right contractors and capabilities and experiences on board? Because a lot of things have to fall over when you're going out to tender on new ideas. And is the skills there with the skill shortages that we see? And then we want to still stay on board as we commission, maintain, and hand back these kind of solutions based on sustainable development. And for me, even more personal now, is the fact that, as I mentioned, climate change and climate action is real. I've had family members in native Pakistan, where my parents are from, suffering from the consequences of climate change. And if you look at Pakistan, an area the size of Great Britain is recently underwater and directly linked to climate change because of unprecedented rainfall, more than 2,500 glaciers in the north melting at alarming rates. And you've seen massive flooding, never seen on a scale before. As I mentioned, I've got personal family members that suffered from that in the city of Karachi. Luckily, they're okay, but the fact is that, you know, this is real and it's happening. And this is more important as innovation. That's not just a case of profit-led innovation, but purpose-led innovation. And now I feel we're in a stage where the two can actually come together. It can still be very profitable, but still be more sustainable in your innovation and your solutions. And for us, we look at the whole triple bottom line that you've probably heard before on the three pillars of sustainability. Yes, we want to be environment responsible in terms of carbon reduction and energy efficiency and ecology, biodiversity, and all these solutions that we now come up with our clients in reducing waste from landfill. But we always look at the economics and make sure there's a business case there. And that's more positive now because of the unfortunate increase in energy prices. But obviously, it's creating an issue with fuel poverty. So we try to link them all. We try to, for example, look at heat networks with the clients and developers, say, okay, there's a social housing scheme over there. Let's take a heat network towards there as well as benefiting the development we're working on to alleviate fuel poverty. And then we look at new upcoming legislation. But the things that we do work in as well within rail is we look at, as I mentioned, heat networks, look at alternative technologies in air quality for diesel exhaust emissions on stations. We're just looking at alternative forms of PV from roofs to solar carports. We do loads of carbon neutral feasibilities, energy efficiencies, and we're doing this first of its kind carbon neutral studies for stations. And we're targeted an area where the biggest kind of issues arise in terms of greenhouse gas emissions and contribution to greenhouse gas emissions and carbon, because nearly 40% of the emissions are from buildings and infrastructure and transport is closely behind this. But this is where we really need to tackle a lot of the issues. And the clients that we work with, predominantly Network Rail, we work with obviously Vansi Rail now and Northern as a train operators, they've also got the added issue of increased cost as well. So when I talk about the triple bottom line, it's not just obviously about targeting carbon, but it's also targeting cost. And now it's becoming more highlighted the fact that their energy price increase, you know, nearly Network Rail are going to be up towards £1 billion in energy costs to run the railway, run the train, to run all their infrastructure and the 2,500 stations that they're landlord for as well. So at the same time, they're recognizing that they need to decarbonize as well. They are the first to set science-based targets as well and target their impacts to global emissions of the limit to 1.5 degrees. But what we find is it doesn't always need a very technical and scientific approach. When we're going in and looking at a lot of these stations and infrastructure and assets, we find that these heating switched on in waiting rooms in areas that there's nobody sat there, no lights is left on. So we're looking at photocells and passive infrared technologies for lighting and setting for heating. And we look at other improvements where lighting has been there's been maintenance going on and photocell technology that is there. Someone's put an override on it because they do maintenance and the SWAT's forgot to reset it. So we find all sorts of situations where these are quick wins, but they'll save a hell of a lot of energy when you separate that out across many hundreds of stations. But then, as I mentioned, we then go further into trying to manage the solutions, implement the solutions, come with different technologies and implementation measures. And then we go into the low carbon technologies of what's out there in terms of wind, solar, heat pumps, what we can implement. And then we look at different methodologies that are accredited because clients want accreditations on the projects. One of them is the BREEAM, I don't know if you've heard of BREEAM, but Building Research Establishments Environmental Assessment Method. Because when you're looking at efficiencies and new technologies and you're looking at new projects, what clients often want is a stamp to say, well, I want to be recognized for the work that we're doing. And we said, great. So we embark on courses and we'll try to make sure that they get that stamp they're looking for and that project can be benchmarked against others. So if you're a BREEAM project, your building might be rated good, very good, excellent, outstanding. And HS2, for example, on their new stations are now trying to achieve a BREEAM level of outstanding. Now, speaking of HS2, I know Professor Bruce mentioned them as well in terms of the project. It is controversial, no doubt, but they are trying to really increase the game in terms of environmental sustainable performance. And although, unfortunately, they are going through some, you know, greenbelt areas and they've got a lot of scrutiny around this, they're really trying to up the game in terms of the contractor performance around the build projects that they're doing across the phase one and phase two. So for example, in the hybrid bill, the Revenue Railway Act, they've put this environmental minimum requirements in there. So contractors have to track their carbon in terms of transportation, track the materials, and air quality needs to be measured and monitored as well. But what we found is we did a piece of work to see what that bar was against normal kind of contractor level within the rail sector. And we found there was a gap there. And in terms of that gap, it was a case of, you know, contractors were not ready in terms of looking at electric diggers and machinery and equipment and looking at hybrid vehicles and decarbonizing their fleet away from diesels and petrol vehicles. And when they try to, and they're coming to enter in the site that's managed by HS2, they need to identify the carbon, the air quality rating, so the Euro code rating of the vehicle in terms of air quality. And these are all being done on spreadsheets and being done by hand with people logging number plates and things and then sending that back to HS2. We've said, hang on a second, this is really old school. And then the innovation side came out and I thought, there's got to be a better way of doing this. And then I went away and I started to speak to some software developers. We started to put an app together and say, well, wouldn't it be great if all this was managed by an app on site and whoever's at the gate of the site can automatically, through AMPR, automatic number plate recognition, log the vehicle coming in. That will identify its Euro code in terms of its air quality. It will identify what materials are coming in, where it's come from, so the transportation carbon, and where it's going to. We can log machinery coming in, all sorts of data. Everything is about data, especially when you're trying to decarbonize. If you don't know what your benchmark is and where you are, you don't know where you're going, really. So this is one side of an area that we're working quite closely in. And as Professor Bruce mentioned, this is one actually that's been going on for some time, but we're not going to kill it. We are going to try to make sure this happens because we know there's a need for it. And when we talk about these pinch points and what hurts your client, is a lot of it's reputation, because now even contractor world and construction is definitely at the poorer scale in terms of sustainability, because it's very hard to track and capture data. And that's one of the big challenges, and that's something that we definitely want to change. Another area where we're very, very big on innovation is air quality. So we manage a lot of issues around air quality across the whole network for Network Rail, particularly more enclosed stations like Birmingham New Street. If anyone's been to Birmingham, you'll probably know that when you stop in, you can probably smell some diesel emissions at times when a train pulls in and it's there idling. Because it's quite an enclosed station, it's a low floor to ceiling and it's a long platform with a big concrete lid on there. So areas like that, we're looking at technologies where traditionally you just have big fans that take the emissions outside. If you take it out outside of the ambient in Birmingham, those that you know, it's actually a clean air zone there now. So it's not the right thing to do. So we're thinking, right, well, there's got to be a solution here. And then the innovation hat comes on and the frustration kicks in. And then we go out to the market and say, there's got to be something out there. So we speak to suppliers and we're now looking at innovation technology like the one in the picture there, a company called Pluvo there, trying to be innovative in terms of latest filtration technology, ionization chemical processes that can capture emissions, filter them and produce cleaner air at the other end. And that's something, you know, air quality is a massive issue. Up to 40,000 premature deaths a year related to air quality. Before COVID, it was like the number one public health issue in this country. And it's a massive issue globally as well. So when we're looking at diesel exhaust emissions from trains, et cetera, stations, again, we're thinking there's got to be better solutions out there. And we're engaging the market. We're giving them ideas. But those that even don't produce something like this, we're saying, have you considered something like this? And even during COVID, we found companies that could manufacture filters that could capture COVID bacteria, et cetera, within a lot of air handling plant and ventilation equipment as well. We rolled them out with Network Rail and others. And then coming on to other sides in terms of going back to the carbon agenda, I've told you some of the figures that we spend, the country spends as public money on the cost of running the network for railways, traction, non-traction. So we're looking at big assets. How can we decarbonize but make it more appealing? And we come up with solutions. So we'll be given a concept, blank canvas of a station. This is one in the Lake District in Oxenholme, for those that are familiar with Cumbria. And we were asked to look at a community-style innovation and design that had some renewable technology, would be a bit iconic and could enhance the station. And so we come up with some solutions like, okay, can we make like a solar meadow? So we come with these solar tree concepts. And this is completely just blank canvas, just ideas that come across us. And we've seen these in the United States. And we thought, okay, well, let's add some seats in there because people are waiting for trains. And then let's look at different types of colors, LED lighting, and then how it works in terms of charging points. So we can have renewable technology that can be stored into a battery below the seats. You can plug your chargers in, your laptops while you're waiting for a train, and it's renewable technology charging your phones. And then we also then look at other problems that we get. And a lot of innovation is from problem solving, because a lot of what we do, we get problems thrown at us from clients like Network Rail and others. And one was a study where we're really trying hard on it to work on for carbon neutrality. Stoke Contrent, those of you familiar with Stoke, a big, great 1-2 listed building. And with a lot of station buildings, you can't just throw solar panels on the roof and say, we're going to do this, going to do that. Very problematic in terms of its structure and weakness and lots of assurance of governance around what you can do on the railway, because you cannot disrupt a railway at all. If you disrupt a train at Birmingham, you can potentially disrupt 60% of the network you can get fines of like £4,000 a minute. And that's the kind of fines that rail could see. So you cannot disrupt the railway, and hence the whole assurance and governance piece around this. So we thought, okay, well, we can't put solar panels on the roof of the station. Can we put it on the car park then? And then they said, what do you mean by that? And we said, okay, let's do some research. So we go away, we find Bentley Motors in Crewe. And they said, come and see us. So we went to see Bentley Motors. We took the client with us, and we said, there's got to be a solution to these problems. We've got to decarbonize. There's a bigger purpose, and there's obviously cost savings. Why don't we do a solar carport at Stoke? So Bentley Motors, we showed them the scheme, I think, because it was a case of not being the first, because this is big risk stuff, big structures, and anything can happen. You don't want something like that collapsing on a new car in the car park or anything. You know, we held to ransom on this, and our heads will be rolling down the road here, or the railway. So we wanted to see who else has done this before. Is it achievable? Is it cost effective? Bentley Motors said, yeah, absolutely, go and do it. So we went away. We then had meetings with Network Rail, Avanti and others, and they said, absolutely, yes, go ahead and do it. So again, blank canvas, we did the design from concept, took it to detail design, and we come up with a way of making it work. It's a battery storage technology. So when the energy is being produced, can it be stored in batteries and used for nighttime lighting? Because a lot of the railways use a lot of power during the night for lights and lifts and escalators. Then we 3D modeled it and look at what the solutions can bring. And then again, more in terms of innovation, is looking at the carbon impacts of building something like this and the disruption to passengers and commuters. So then we thought, can it be brought in big sections prefabricated offsite? So now you might hear in the media, there's a big drive to prefabricated homes to bring the cost of developing and building homes less than prefabricated buildings. So we're looking at prefabricated solutions for challenges like this as well. So in essence, yeah, we enjoy everything we do because innovation is a big part, and having that luxury, I guess, an opportunity, but luxury is the wrong word because it's not really a luxury when we have to do some of the hard work around it, but the opportunity with some of these clients is great for a small SME like us, is looking to grow for the right reasons of having a purpose, trying to be innovative, trying to keep local in terms of our growth as well, and also be as diverse as we can as well. And we're very, very big on trying to be diverse and engage all different communities to attract different ideas and talents from everywhere. So yeah, we've been fortunate to be recognised for some of that. But going back to technologies as well, is we have to keep on top of the game, particularly in engineering solutions. There's always innovation happening, it's always change. So one of the biggest issues we find is things are constantly shifting, particularly when it comes to sustainable solutions. One of them is smart technologies. We'll find out a lot of equipment, even in your homes, your lights, your TVs, etc. You know, you can all link them up by voice activation and everything else. And that's happening on a bigger scale now with buildings as well. So that's something we're trying to tap into, but looking at it again for a bigger purpose of sustainable development and looking at carbon and energy. So now going back to our scenario with train stations and what I said about the conditions we find where lights are left on and heating's left on, can we take that technology that we know is tried and tested, and can we shift it into the railways and try and adapt it there for the purpose of achieving low carbon infrastructure and stations? So we've again teamed up with a supplier, and we've done a lot of the legwork around this. It's a company called Utopia, great company to work with in terms of innovative thinking. And they were traditionally in the student accommodation sector, residential. And we've again had discussions and said, well, can we adapt that technology into the rail sector? And said, we never thought about this. So spoke to their board and had lots of meetings. And now we're trialing this in an innovation fund, actually, to trial this across stations where you can get granular data, first of its kind, where it can actually identify how much energy is being accumulated and used in a waiting room and in a foyer and in a ticket office. We never had that kind of data before. We've never known that kind of data. And that's now being achieved through the work we're doing and trialing and testing within the sector. And again, we get a lot of reports from out of this as well. We get all the details. And to a point where we can find that lights are being left on. We can see that through the night because there's a certain level of lighting that's being maintained through the data we're gathering. But we can go back to the client and say, these lights, we're getting a constant 400 lux here. So this means the lights are being left on in a certain room or canteen or something overnight. I said, oh yeah, we can see that. Right, let's do something about it. And we're getting data on waiting rooms if they're overheating due to the heat wave, which we recently had. We're thinking, okay, well, wouldn't it be good if we had some blinds against the window? And we did this, and we can reduce the temperature, increase ventilation. So it's a strategy-led means. But we're at a stage now where we're growing our team, got two of our key team players here today. And I've always been very big on trying to acquire graduates and empower them, because I do feel that in big organizations where graduates enter into, they're almost like left to, you just do that bit there, just do that calculation. Because I had that when I thought I was a graduate for some years. But I really throw them a bit in the deep end, and within a month, the client facing, and they really try to push them in terms of identifying solutions and challenge and really question the status quo, what's out there in terms of innovation. But there is challenges out there to get skilled resources at the moment, big challenge that many organizations will agree with me on that at the moment. And retaining good people is a bigger, even bigger issue, because you do get a lot of the big organizations that will just offer them and say, come to us and we'll do this and we'll do that. And then we're at a stage also when to scale up, we now need to get into the big world of tendering and writing big bids and things. And we're finding that we're teaming up with some big energy companies that have come to us again. Great. Really, really flattered that we've been approached by some of the big organizations to team up on certain tenders, particularly within the railway. But as I mentioned before, training, development, keeping on top of technology in the shifting world, and constant evolution advancements is one of the key issues and challenges we find. And therefore, most nights we're up reading about what is the next thing that's coming up in terms of controls and innovation and sustainability in a shifting environment. So how do you for time? We've got okay for time. Key issue is innovation is key to grow. As Professor Bruce really well highlighted, is you can't just stay as you are and expect growth of a company, or expect profit. But for us, as I mentioned, the purpose is just as big as the profit in the work that we do. And that is key for us. And that's really where we try to strive to enforce that with our clients as well. And we also find that we're trying to do a culture change shift with them as well. So when we're producing a lot of these solutions and forwarding them, presenting them, we're also then talking about diversity, talking about social inclusion. We're talking about fuel poverty and how we can do things in the community. And the organizations that we're working with are absolutely loving that, them ideas. We want to see more and hear more. And that's, again, because of the shifting culture we've seen with a lot of shareholders and owners of companies that want to go down the right path as well. And timing is key. You know, if I just worked in a normal engineering role, something for years gone by, I probably would have missed this opportunity to start this and fulfill what my dream is, to create a real purpose-led organization that still makes profit, but you have to be brave, be bold. I still remember when I started Houston, I played asleep for about a week thinking, am I doing the right thing? Because I'm on the verge of buying property and taking a mortgage and everything else. So time wasn't great, but it's never the right time. You've just got to take that step. And what I've also mentioned is keep learning and developing. For scaling up, you have to make sure training and development is top priority. And that is absolutely key for scaling up. And like with the railways and other sectors we're working in, you can't expect to achieve different results if you're doing the same thing again and again. And Albert Einstein was great in saying that. Some of our clients, we're really, again, flattered that we've got some high-profile clients with small SME that we are. And we are growing and looking to grow. So I think just on time there. Okay, time for Q&A. Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. That was fantastic. We'll might Bruce back up if you want to see this art. Q&A up here. That's fantastic.
Yeah, very good.
You two have been very busy. Great. Well, I'm going to start off with a couple questions, and then we'll go to the room and online. As I would start with you, because I loved your comment that you were seen as a disruptor or perhaps more of a troublemaker. So in that facing that kind of environment and perhaps resistance to innovation, how do you tackle that? How do you get people on side? How do you get past that?
Yeah, it's not easy. I think in a situation that I gave as an example, that project at Birmingham, it was a case of sustainability was just now emerging as a key topic area. Mm-hmm. And the lucky thing for me at the time was a lot of the key funders realized that and they wanted more solutions around sustainable development. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's a case of getting key stakeholders on board behind me so they could then come in at a higher level and then penetrate the kind of project level, say, no, he's talking sense, let's really do this. Mm-hmm. And I just had to position myself with some of them key stakeholders and almost have, meetings outside of, formal gatherings in there and just really just encourage that kind of thought process and culture change, really. That was the key, is to just change the mindset. Mm-hmm. But fortunate for me at the time, policies were changing, strategies were changing for big organizations. I never really knew they had to become more sustainable. So I was just on the verge of where this was becoming mainstream topic. Otherwise, to be honest, it wasn't that case. I probably would have struggled. I probably would have still been fighting today. But yeah, I was fortunate in that case.
Okay. Are you finding less resistance moving forward? Are people getting, yeah, it's getting easier?
Yeah, it's getting a lot easier. Get a lot more inquiries, a lot more engagement, really. But when I look back 10, 12 years ago, completely different environments where we are.
Thank you. To the question for you, Bruce. You talked about doing the right projects and doing the projects well. I think I have that right. So how and when do you decide that it's not going right? It's not the right project or it's not going well. How do you make those tough decisions and maybe you go in that as well? But...
Yeah, so I guess, you know, so projects, so if it's drifting, right, if you're reducing its scope, I think you always got to try and remember what you're trying to achieve, right? So typically a project's, what do they say about projects? Project triangle, isn't it? That's on time, on budget, or scope, right? And so typically that gets reduced. So if you're starting to trim the project, features off the project, it's no longer an attractive project, attractive product offer, right? So I guess you've got to go back and say, what is it we're really trying to achieve? What can we not afford to take out of this? Mm-hmm.
And you've seen that as well, making some of those tough decisions to perhaps move on, change direction a little bit or make a tough call.
Yeah, there is elements of that sometimes, but we're quite stubborn. So we had to we tried to convince the client when we're sure, and again, going back to that triple bottom line analogy, mm-hmm, if you know there's a business case for it, if you know you're going to make a positive environment impact on the environment, and there is some social benefit as well, mm-hmm, you know, if we can tick down key boxes, that we really try and push and say, what the reason is to not do this? Mm-hmm. And if it is a case of, as the professor says, maybe scoping or cost, sometimes we do get challenges and cost comes in as a big issue, because a lot of the time we are dealing with public funds and they're always tight and always do get cut. But if there's a benefit there, we find that the benefit is easy now to demonstrate because of the unfortunate increased cost of energy. Mm-hmm. We do find that there's less resistance now because we're demonstrating that triple bottom line, really. Which is what we always got back to from a lot of our discussions.
It sounds so a lot of the work, the more work you do up front, perhaps can improve the viability of the project overall.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think another key is understanding, as we've put really well, is understanding the client and their sensitivities. Mm-hmm. For example, in the railway sector, operating the trains is key. You know, you cannot be seen as being too innovative where you're not being sensible and you're not really being cognizant of the key risks around the railway infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So understanding the insurance, you know, we have to go through all these stage gate reviews. Actually, we're real big on this. Every time we do a design, we go from concept to scheme, stage gate, scheme to detail design, stage gate. Mm-hmm. And before you embark with contractors, another stage gate. Mm-hmm. So we're very familiar with that area and territory. And for us, the key is understanding the client sensitivities. And it's very different in social housing. They'll have different sensitivities around cost, mm-hmm, and program and contractors and skills. But I think key is understanding what the pinch points and sensitivities are and then work around them, but always keep on top of the agenda. You have to always go back to your risks. Mm-hmm. And if you're seen as drifting from them risks and almost ignoring them, thinking, oh, it'll be all right on the night kind, mm-hmm, of approach, then you're setting yourself up for failure there.
Great. I love seeing the theory and the practice coming together beautifully. That's nice to see. I'll just check out the room here. Any questions in the room?
One from the online audience.
Okay, great. So, and then we'll go to the
later
today. Yeah,
question. So Gary Young has asked, do you follow any best practice for the identification, consideration, and introduction of innovation? And if yes, can you share details or examples?
Well, that's what we were trying to convey earlier. From all that sense. So, I mean, I suppose one of the things that's quite difficult about best practice is that I think best practice varies with where you are in your ability to innovate. So, I mean, I think things like StageGate is quite a basic tool, right? But it's a kind of beginner's tool. So it's a bit like, you know, learning a sport, right? You wouldn't want to probably learn a sport off Roger Federer of tennis because it's too good, right? So you kind of build it up. So I think best practices are not absolute. I think they tend to be, depend on where you are in your innovation journey. I mean, you guys sound like you're innovating a lot, you've experienced at it. Whereas other businesses will be very occasional innovators. So I think the best practice for an occasional rare innovator is different from a continuous innovator, right? Just as a sports person would be kind of finding, you know, would use different tools to a beginner.
Yeah, I think for us, I won't say we don't follow any kind of textbook on innovation at all, to be honest with you. A lot of the ideas are very different because we have different clients, different scenarios, in a completely different atmosphere, project to project, different sensitivities, different sets of risks. So to be honest, we don't follow any textbook on innovation.
I think following textbook would be a negative impact on innovation because it's...
You can constrain yourself. Yeah. But I think indirectly, you are following a lot of the guidance that Professor Booth actually talked about, and then stage gates and you know, whether you want to kill something that's gone on too long or you don't. I think indirectly, some of the things you talked about, actually, I've been thinking about, we're actually doing that, we're prolonging this, and I'll probably go back tomorrow and think about a lot of these things. Because it is easy to just start on something and you just keep it going for the sake, and you really need to have that realisation. Is there a case for it? Is there a benefit for it? Will ultimately somebody take this forward and take it on for a good reason? If there isn't, there's no real point then in taking it further.
It sounds like trying to maintain some objectivity, which can be very difficult when you're very close to a project. And
There's
a question about
that. Yeah, I was just curious. We always concentrate on client satisfaction. In terms of strikes for several months, also businesses are very concentrated on productivity and effectiveness of employees. How do you see innovation to impact the employee satisfaction and less strikes in railway? Do you see any possibility for this as well?
For the railway, the strikes, I think, is quite a different kind of scenario in what's going on with the unions and obviously salaries, etc. Yeah. In terms of satisfaction, though, it's interesting you mentioned that because I actually had a call with somebody in the Middle East a couple of days ago about how sustainability can link with health and well-being and satisfaction in the workplace. And we're looking at doing elements of work where some of the projects that didn't show it today, but we're looking at things like green wall technologies. How can green walls and planting can help in biodiversity, but also help someone's well-being when they're at the workplace? Sometimes client satisfaction on the railway can be they're working in a dark, dingy train station every day. You know, they're exposed to emissions and diesel exhaust and things. So they're the kind of things that we're trying to tackle to make sure there's a bit more satisfaction in the workplace around that. The concept we showed you in the railway with the trees and the solar panels on there, that is part of that as well, to try and create a more appealing station for people to not just work in, but commuters and passengers. So indirectly, we're working towards that area of greater satisfaction in the workplace by more attractive stations, by making them more sustainable. But unfortunately, the bigger issues around strikes, we don't have that power as a small company to try and...
Would be
more
solution reasons?
No, I understand what you mean.
So a couple of thoughts on that. I mean, one is that sometimes innovation is disruptive to people's work patterns. I mean, for example, I was teaching my students about Procter & Gamble, right, last week. And they changed the way they innovated from being dependent on their own R&D production, basically, to being sourcing ideas outside. And that made the internal people worry, right? Does Procter & Gamble no longer need us? I think we're going to get replaced. I mean, innovation can be disruptive to what people do. And what we know about people is that people who lose things tend to complain a lot, and people who gain things often don't say very much, right? So they're quite quietly happy that their situation is improving, whereas the people who are losing out moan like hell. So I guess I think your previous answer to another question was like how you kind of got stakeholders important to that forward. So I think we have to recognize that innovation does involve change, and often people aren't going to be happy about it. But I guess you have to push those things through sometimes. The other thing that occurred to me is I was remembering that it was an airline, right? And they were trying to change the way in which they provided their on flight services. And I remember the manager telling me really important to have the kind of staff, right, the air hostesses, the hosts, involved in the process. Because unless you have them involved in the process, they kind of resist it. You've got to try and make it their process as well as your own. So don't just, it's kind of just impose all the solutions on people. You've got to bring them with you.
Wait here and then another.
Some questions from the online audience.
Okay, online, great.
Yeah. So two questions kind of linked in together. So Paul Cochran asked, is agile methodology better than stage gates? And that kind of links in what Mohammed has raised, asked whether a stage gate process should incorporate the feedback loops.
So I'd say that I would start with the stage gates and move to agile. So that was kind of what I was trying to say about being a beginner, then move up, right? So, you know, learn the basic tool and then get more sophisticated. So should it involve feedback loops? Well, if it's meant that it has loops to go back to previous stages, then yes, it should. So I just presented a very simplified version of the concept there. But yes, it can. It certainly can be, yes.
John,
over here.
Hi, my name's John. I work for the Graphene Engineering Innovation Centre, and I want to talk about the adoption of new material technologies. Looking at some new clients up there, we've worked with McLaren, for example, they've adopted new technologies, but it's in a de-risk situation. Really interested in your talk about adopted technologies in large-scale infrastructure projects. Obviously, what's about good focus on low carbon technologies around cementitious materials. What's your view on the stakeholders in the supply chain adopting new technologies, especially around where standards and verifications have got to be verified? This is where one of the challenges that we're seeing is the adoption of, for example, the design of new cements, where it doesn't have the historic certification that the industry requires for de-risking large-scale projects. We get that. What's your experience in the adoption of technologies where certification is required? Can you share any experiences about how that is adopted? It's a fairly big challenge that we see. Largely, I'm in material science, so I apologize, I'm not a business developer, but it is about the upscale of technologies, which is just as important as organization change. So it alludes to what Professor Bree said before, it's more about product development. We appreciate we've got to go to scalability, and we're in that role at the University of Manchester with delivering projects. But it's about the adoption of that technology on large-scale construction projects. If you can share any...
It's great you've actually mentioned graphene, because I was on a call only last week with a company that's looking at graphene technology in paints that can then improve air quality by absorbing NOx and CO2. I don't know whether you're aware of this.
Yes, so many technologies of where graphene is used. It's not just...
Yeah.
No, we don't call it the fix, it doesn't tell you applying the technology. Fire retardancies,
right.
Low carbon construction, asphalt is all the areas.
Yeah.
Anti-corrosion. So there's many applications, but all we're coming up against the same standards about adoption.
Verification.
So
it is, I'll be honest, in the rail sector it's very tough because the product approval process is very, very stringent. A lot of the ways we, once they get around this, but get to approval verification is have the trial period. So we try to get a small sum of money that's from the innovation fund or something. We'll go through the competition process and everything. We'll do all the applications. So just let's trial an area. And if it can trial an area demonstrating it's there for 6 months, 8 months, not saying with what we're planning with the air filtration equipment, rather than going all out, whole scale and big scale, because I do want a small example on some of the smart technologies I mentioned, even with something like that, the product's process and approval process is very stringent. And one reason is you take station radios, for example, GSMR, you know, is there a risk that some of the languages and some of the, you know, interaction with the technology that we're using, can that interact with some station radio? Can disrupt it? Shouldn't do, but there's always a risk. And it's just questions like that will be thrown at you from some comms engineer or something. It has to go through that process. It is very challenging, I'll be honest. And I think that's one of the issues where that sector that we work in has been quite slow on take up. But it's a case of going through that pain. You know, and we're prepared to do that. And I think probably one of the benefits of a smaller organization is we've got that probably ability to be more agile and be a bit more patient, because the win would be massive for something like us, whereas bigger organizations, like one of many probably, that'll be trialing. So the answer is, it is very difficult. I think with our engineering background, though, we can very quickly home in on what the issues would be and what the risks would be. And even with the solar medal I mentioned, showed you on there, the amount of questions that have been thrown at us for that. You know, we're at this stage now, detail design going into construction.
Very interesting that the outstanding jobs are being talking about, but that represents, what you just said, is a lot of the smaller SMEs are actually far more agile to adopt these technologies than given some of the big infrastructure delivery firms and where it's all about this.
Yeah.
But we are engaged in those small trials, really, it's trying to get to the large infrastructure, which is really where the key savings are, especially for sustainability.
But yeah.
It's quite interesting. So,
yeah, no, but definitely we'll catch up to it. But with a technology like that, we're just finding to start small, do a trial period, and that in itself will make product approval verification a lot easier because it's rather than going full scale.
It sounds like the approval process could use innovation.
Yeah.
Maybe that could be another business for you. More questions in the room or online? I've got another one to fire away.
Yes, please. About the people in your company, you mentioned that you struggle to recruit, I mean, the recruitment and with the staff is very important. And that is also linked to how valuable are the younger people to generational innovation. So, what type of skills you're looking for, and how difficult it is to find the skills that you need. And what happens when they leave?
So when they leave, I cry. You know, it can be very upsetting because I put a lot of hard work and a lot of time and effort into them. But for me, as I mentioned in the talk, is empowering a lot of our young graduates and youth, particularly in climate action, because you know, it's the younger generation that are going to suffer more than we are. So for us, what we're doing in the projects we're working on, I find that a lot of the graduates are really putting their heart into it because they really care. And I think that's a very important part of really enjoying what you do and having a purpose about what you do and not just all about profit. And that's what I think generally, I think there's a lot of studies around this area now where a lot of workforce are more happy when they can see a wider purpose of what they do, particularly in the climate action realm. But yeah, it is very difficult, particularly where I think there's a skills shortage at the moment. I'm very surprised that there's not enough courses at the moment around low carbon technology. I think recent studies are showing school leavers, only 50% of school leavers have a big awareness around climate action and climate and renewable technologies. And that really needs to be increased. I'm quite lucky that I guest lecture in Manchester University for a master's course in low carbon technology. So I sometimes go to the professor and say, who's your best pick of graduates each year? And to be honest, those that you see here are from that process. So I don't go out to, recruitment consultants or agencies to say who you've got. I do it slightly clever, whether that's fully legal. I hope it is. Just let it in an open forum. But we just get applications come to us random as well. Some certain lectures, the forums will be in flight today. I'll just get a CV the next day and say, I'm really keen to work for you, or I've got a big interest. And the big tick in the box for me is they've showed an interest. As soon as they show a big interest, for me, they're almost 50% there. The next is about their credentials and, keenness and their personalities, etc. To me, it's all about willingness to learn. Unfortunately, there is a lot of people out there that just think they deserve it because they've got a good degree or their background, a privileged background or something. It's not about that. It's not about that. We want to be as diverse as possible. We want to make sure we go into the communities that I feel are not represented, particularly in terms of climate action, and they're the communities are going to suffer the most in climate change. The urban, densely populated communities, even around Greater Manchester, I feel they don't have as big a voice. I feel they don't get the opportunities. I feel, I was in that kind of space as well when I was a youngster. And unfortunately, there is prejudices out there. There is stereotypes out there. And we really want to break down barriers in the way we grow and be as diverse as possible. And that's a big issue for me because I feel we don't tap into all the communities equally. And therefore, we're missing out on gathering thoughts and ideas from a whole community. We tend to just see, if you go to board level still now, in all the big organizations, and railway is one of them, on an operation level, you'll see a very diverse set of people. Whether you're going to a railway station, you do see diversity. When you go to board level and you present there, unfortunately, you don't see anything like that. It's very underrepresented. So unfortunately, I feel that's still the case. these organizations do recognize that now, but I don't feel there's really a plan there to change it. And for me, I just feel like I'm in a fortunate position now. You know, we're a small entity, we're going into schools, we're going to colleges. You know, we're doing that now down south with a client in Oxford who really understands the importance of diversity and inclusion. And we've put a set of slides together. Yara's done that with us and lovely. And we're going soon to go to talk to 14, 15-year-olds and even younger to talk about climate change action. But the fact that it's everyone's problem, it's not just a case of few privileged that will be empowered and get into jobs where they can make that difference. It's everyone's issue and everyone's got an opportunity, because this will be a growing sector and this can help in terms of emerging growing economies. So yes, I'll give you a very long answer there. For every job. You know, so I hope that answers what you're asking.
We've got I work for a company that's quite a large M&A contract, and one of our clients, a big multinational drinks company, and they challenged us basically this week to give a presentation against basically planning to support multiple biomass projects across the globe. They've got £10 billion to spend on it. They're really focused on just doing biomass to produce their drinks. One of the challenges, we mainly work in Nigeria with them,
right?
And we're looking at basically the source of, you know, the agri waste that they're doing for it. They don't have the data to work with the local farmers to implement that to know if it's working or not. So the main question is, how do you adapt to those developing economies and situations where those multinational companies need to provide them the data in that scenario?
Great question. That's a great project to work on.
It is.
I mean, the biomass obviously can have issues with security of supply and also sourcing of supply. But you might have the data initially, but solutions like the example to give you is create them innovation solutions now. And
what,
say, okay.
You hear Rockwell Automation?
Who?
Rockwell Automation. They've developed something really similar called Beamsworks.
Right.
So it's basically energy monitoring technology. We can adapt it, link it to the weather. What you demonstrate is very similar.
Okay.
But the data is there in certain environments. That's the main issue.
And indeed, projects basically Africa-based, what these?
This one is Nigeria, Mexico, Indonesia.
Wow.
And
yeah, and with something like that, you probably want to do a desktop study first and go and speak to the supply chain and see, you know, who is the suppliers that you go to or want to use, and then go and speak to them initially and do some real intrusive investigations around sources of biomass and who they use and how it's created and sourced from, etc. And to me, you'd have to be some really old school kind of research first in depth, and then gather that to desktop study, then go into the detail around and how can we then capture this and create some sort of certification processes. And they might get mandated in areas like Nigeria, for example. Mm-hmm. So I'd have to really think outside the box there and think, right, let's really go big here. Because, gosh, if we had clients like that, I'd be all over it, you know. But yeah, I think it's a big challenge. It's a great opportunity. But go intrusive, really, and speak to them and say, right, we want to know who you're considering. Get go and speak to them.
Well, if you've got time later, if you get people to speak to the client.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. Absolutely. Okay. I could grow on the back of that even more. Then. So I've got to scale up for it. It's all about.
We have any more questions online?
Yeah, got a question online from Gemma. Can long-term planning for large complex organisations be harmonised to short-term agile mindsets to achieve innovation?
Well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, you've got to, you know, it's some journey, isn't it? So you've got a long-term goal, so how are you going to get there? So break it down into stages and do it bit by bit. And I suppose that's what I would intuitively think is the answer to that question.
Yeah, I mean, with large organizations, a lot of them have a lot of resources and capital behind to innovate and create that plan, create their plans. For smaller ones like us, to be honest, a lot of it is kind of trial and error. You know, what if we see a need, and then we'll go for it. But I think we do have the agility though to adapt and with clients quite quickly and jump on certain key challenges and issues. But to be honest with you, we haven't set a strategy out, certainly nothing like in them slides to say, this is what we're going to go, because there's such a shifting pattern in the work that we do.
Yeah.
More on that.
I mean, that's partly because, I mean, in larger organizations, there's a test, tends to be more separation between the sort of strategic activities and the more operational activities, right? Yeah. So in a small organization, they're kind of mashed together. But in a large organization, there's kind of separation. So you have, like, the board in charge of long-term direction and then how to implement that will trickle down.
Good question.
Good.
So I have another question, actually, I'll be able to throw it out there. So Bruce, you were talking earlier about almost one in five good companies have sort of innovated in the past handful of years. Definitely a very low number. So my question to both of you is, how do we fuel or inspire or motivate more innovation in these companies that, for whatever reason, are not doing it now? Because obviously we need more.
Yeah, it's surprising, isn't it? So I think that they need to understand better how to manage innovation in a fairly basic way, right? Mm-hmm. So I think if we had we disseminate how to innovate. So if you look at things like the innovation objective or target of 2.5% R&D, that's all great, but it doesn't tell us how to get there, does it? It doesn't tell us how we're going to get to increasing R&D to 2.5%. So for me, I think there's lots of kind of basic ways to innovate. That's why I'm a big fan of design and develop, mm-hmm. because I think you can use lots of design tools. It's trying to understand, you know, what is the challenges that your clients are facing, trying to incorporate that into development. And so if you do break it down, sort of demystify innovation, make it more of a kind of routine practice that can be done. Mm-hmm. To use tools like the business model canvas is a great tool, right? So, I mean, I'm presuming that companies don't innovate, A, because they don't have to, and B, because they're kind of worried that innovation is somehow some scary thing that they're going to waste their money on, right? So if you can sort of see how they could, you can help them, inform them, A, it's not that scary, right? If you do the right projects and you do them well, you should benefit. And you get the outcome. I mean, obviously, yeah, as you were saying, it's not necessarily just for growth and profit, it may be for purpose, right? So what are you trying to achieve and how can innovation help you achieve that? But if we can demystify it, I think that will go a long way to increasing the rate of which we've got.
Yeah, and I think funding pots are a big issue as well, because I know the likes of Innovate UK and other similar kind of pathways to try and acquire funding to innovate. We've gone for applications and it can take a long time, be really, really difficult. And then at the end, you get disheartened because you've come closer, you've not, then you spent hours and hours and days on this. And the other aspect is having client backing as well. So if you're not going for funding from any grant funds or anything, is getting client endorsement. Maybe you might, you know, have a fund there that you can tap into in a big organization or a big public company. Which can be, but they're very few and far between. Mm-hmm. I think if there's more pots of them available, even on small projects, we could do small trial. The gentleman mentioned about, you know, looking at issues around verification and product approval. We just do something small scale, but it had some funding behind it, mm-hmm. then I think there'd be more innovation. But it is concerning because I think as a country, and I love my history, for me, the civilizations that have prospered, the ones that have always innovated, but that have been militarily civilization and technology is key. You have to keep moving forward and innovating. And I think it's a risk we'll fall behind if we don't continue to do that. And it's just having ideas, sharing ideas, is a good start.
Yeah.
I would say that from that, just around the idea of collaboration, you mentioned a lot of projects within those collaborations with suppliers to innovate on the solution. What about innovating with others? So others, either cross-industry, cross, you know, public-private partnerships,
yeah.
maybe with a potential competitor or someone that's outside of your space. What can either of you comment about on that and sort of broadening that, you know, collaborating with others for ideas and innovation and development and efficiency and such?
Collaboration is massive there. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, portals like LinkedIn is great, so sometimes you can find them right collaborations. I think for us, is we often reinvent the wheel when we look at innovation. And what we don't often find is what's going on in other sectors. So what we started to do is, okay, we're predominantly rail, but we go to the healthcare sector and see what good practice they're doing. And one idea is looking at power purchase agreements, lease agreements, third-party funded on big renewable projects. So because nothing done in rail, who has done it? We went to the health sector and got some suppliers in on board there that we're having discussions with. The example I showed about the energy monitoring,
They are big, as I mentioned, in residential sector, particularly student accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
They've never done rail, but we knew that that technology could be adapted really well. So for us, it's definitely don't always have to reinvent the wheel. Go out to suppliers that are in completely different markets. And what we've done is actually we picked up the phone to them, and it came through a mutual client we're working with outside of the rail sector, residential. And he just said, oh, I might want to speak to these guys. Picked up the phone, had a chat, and they were like, we've never thought of rail. Yeah, it'd be great to work with you, you know. And then that went to their board, and their board said, great, another market could be there for us, you know. So, yeah, definitely, I think we make mistakes of trying to reinvent the wheel. We should always look at what other sectors are doing and expertise.
Mm-hmm.
Bentley Motors is a great example on solar car. Of course, we went to car manufacturer, again, completely outside our rail sector.
Mm-hmm.
But they were doing, implementing something that we thought could be adapted to not just one station, but thousands of stations in the future. So, yeah, definitely, I think we collaboration, cross-sector is key for innovation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so much of it, I think, it involves moving something that works in one context into another context.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, I think, again, sort of the mystification problem, right? People think it's about invention and then doing something clever, inventing something, and then they commit, that's the hard bit, right? But then a lot of innovation. So one way, okay, so here's a bit, I'll try this idea with you, but may or may not work. So one way you can think about sort of technology space is that technology is a bit like building blocks, like Lego, right? So yeah, if it takes a lot of energy to use a new building block, right? And the point is that as you combine building blocks, the opportunity space becomes very big, right? And the point is, as we grow the number of building blocks available, possibility space to combine existing building blocks absolutely becomes enormous, right? Much larger than it is the invention of the new building block. And for me, that's the message I want to kind of make about innovation. So much is about refining new combinations of things which work well, or putting things which work well from one context into another context, or even doing fairly basic things like finding out where people are like leaving the lights on, finding a solution to that. You know, so a lot of it is kind of very low level and, if you like, even mundane, right? But it's important and impactful. And so rather than sort of start with a big, challenging, must invent something new kind of mindset, it's really starting at the bottom, right? Mm-hmm. It's starting to look at how we can improve things, where are the points of pain, where are the gains to be made, and solving those things. Right?
Back to those innovation myths you were talking about, and you don't
absolutely
need to be the first mover, you don't need the big idea, you can iterate off what's there,
no,
for sure. Yeah, fantastic, great. I'll just check in again online and in the room. Okay, I've got a couple more questions, and we are just about to wrap up. But I want to pick up, there was an earlier question about, it's come up a lot about skill and hiring for innovation. But what about existing workforces and training for innovation? Comments from either of you on that, people that might be resistant or just don't have the experience, or, you know, how do you train for innovation?
I mean, two elements to that. One is the technical training around the areas that you work in,
mm-hmm.
and then that creates support process around resolving certain key issues that clients might forward via innovation. The other aspect for that, I think, is the mindset in creating an organization that has a culture of sharing ideas and innovation. So if you create that culture where, you know, the leadership endorses ideas, and they may be the silliest of ideas that may not go anywhere, but the fact is creating that culture that, you know, it's okay to share ideas, no matter how crazy they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's definitely two aspects of that in any organization that will help develop that kind of innovative thinking.
Great.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important also to think about hiring, you know, having people who are adaptable in that sense, right? And hiring people who can adapt. Well, remember, there was an old study, as some data study now, but it was a kind of interesting study which compared textile manufacturing in Germany with textile manufacturing in Britain, right? And so this is a bit of an old study, but it kind of makes the point about skills, right? So apparently the British workers were not able to read instructions, right? They were not able to follow instructions. So what happened was that they were basically given one piece of item to make, right? And then they made this in large batches because they weren't adaptable, right? Whereas the German workers were each given different instructions, okay? And therefore, we're making different products. Each worker was essentially making a different product. And the changeover from product to product was very much easier, right? The adaptability was higher. Of course, this leads you to be active in very different markets, right? Because one is in a market of mass manufacturing, low cost, right? And the other is in fast changing, it's much more agile. So the nature of the skills was crucial for the ability of the firm to do different things and be adaptable, right? I'm not quite sure that entirely holds now, but I still think our education system isn't great at creating adaptable skills, especially, you know, amongst the many people who aren't lucky enough to go to university or get higher education, right? In a sense, our skills problem is not this side of the education divide, right? So we're good. We've always been good at the top bit. It's a lot of other workers who are much more challenging for.
Which is a much bigger population.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll just maybe ask for sort of as a last question / closing remarks from you both. So the purpose of our forum here today was around achieving innovation, discussing strategies to effectively facilitate innovation in a fast-growing business. So I'm going to end with the beginning. Where does a company start if they want to get onto this path and they're trying to be a fast-growing business, they want to innovate? What's that simple thing that they can start with, or where do they begin? Or begin again, maybe?
I think one of the strap lines I thought there was be brave and be bold.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Well, I think it's about finding out what you're about. So in this particular case, it's about combining a sort of passion for sustainability with achieving a profit, right? Mm-hmm. So that defines your space to a large extent, right? And then you innovate within that space. So that guides you to where you want to go. It guides you around the things that are going to be acceptable for you to do and mm-hmm. things that are not going to be acceptable for you to do. Another company might take a completely different idea about what it's going to achieve, and therefore its outcomes are different. So I guess if there's one takeaway from me, it's kind of play around with those that business model canvas idea, right? You really can play with that and think about what it is that we do, reflect on what you do, how you do it, how you can change what you do, right? How you can improve upon what you do, and implement those changes.
I guess it's be brave, be bold, and play around. There we go.
And stop playing around. Well, maybe I should say that.
With the canvas.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, okay. With the canvas.
Well, thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you everyone in the room, you and the world of health today and online. And I guess we'll see you at the next scale up event.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you found this episode insightful. For a list of our latest webinars, news, and useful business content, please visit ambs.ac.uk.